From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Have you heard there's a total solar eclipse coming to mid-Missouri? It seems like everybody is talking about it, and we're no exception. Recently, MU professor and director of astronomy Angela Speck sat down with me and my colleague, Harvest Public Media reporter Chris Husted. We talked about why the chance to see a total solar eclipse is so rare, how scientists and citizens are preparing to gather information, and how animals and plants might react to the sudden darkness. Here's our conversation. Angela, can you tell me, what is an eclipse and how are people in different parts of the world going to experience this differently as opposed to people here in central Missouri?
A solar eclipse happens when the moon gets between us and the sun. And there are different types of eclipses. It's much more common to see a partial eclipse than it is to see a total eclipse. When we have an eclipse, and we have them happening somewhere on the planet almost every year, it's basically about once a year, but it's just less than that. That happens, but the place that gets to see that total eclipse is only about 0.1% of the surface of the Earth. Mm-hmm. So even though they happen every year, in a given location, they're very rare. And so in terms of what people get to see in different places, actually, the U.S. is the only country that sees totality, where it's actually totally eclipsed. But as you move away from the place where you can see the total eclipse, you can imagine that, you know, just outside of that area, you're in a place where most of the sun gets blocked out. And as you move further away, less and less of the sun is blocked out. So in this case, we'll have, you know, a 90% eclipse in places like Denver or Chicago. And then as we move further out, even in Maine, which is as far away as you can get from the path of totality and still be on mainland U.S., you're going to get about a 50% eclipse. But all the way to, you know, it encompasses the whole of Canada, the whole of Central America, Greenland, the Caribbean, northern South America. There's even a little piece of Western Europe and West Africa that will see a partial eclipse. So, you know, in the U.S., on the mainland, it's at least 50% and up to 100%. And then even Alaska and Hawaii get a 20% eclipse. So it's going to be experienced by, you know, the Western Hemisphere in some way or other over most of that. And it's going to be the most watched celestial event ever.
Really? And is that just because people are more aware of it now? Or?
Right. I mean, if you think about, like, say, it's something that it happens every year, but often they're in places that are very inaccessible. And so this is one where it's over an area that's quite heavily populated, but also technological. And we now have social media. The last time we had an eclipse on U.S. soil was 1991. That was in Hawaii. Well, I didn't even have email in 1991. I was a junior in college, and I didn't have email. So, you know, at this point, many more people know about it. And people are, you know, the internet and social media has really helped to spread the ideas of science and that there are cool things to see. But it means that everybody's going to want to come and see this.
So the path of totality is this path that sort of seems to arch from the southeastern United States across to the northwestern United States. And I was talking with some friends the other day and they said, oh, well, my friend in, I think, Nebraska is really happy because they're going to see the total eclipse. And I was like, oh, but I thought only us here in central Missouri were going to see it. But obviously that's not the case.
Right. So the path where you can see the total eclipse really does, it extends basically from the Pacific all the way to the Atlantic. And in fact, it's over ocean more than it's over land, but there's nothing in the ocean. Mm-hmm. So, well, there might be some fish. But over the U.S., it's over 2,500 miles that actually gets to see it. So you've got this ribbon that goes from, and it's basically the coast of Oregon to the coast of South Carolina. And it's about 70 miles wide, but it goes all the way across the country. And that's everybody who gets to see total darkness.
And so what's happening now is that people who are on the other side of the world from us, their lives are going to go on as normal. In fact, it's nighttime over there, so they're not seeing anything. And there are many eclipses that we never get to see at all. But for this moment, we are turned toward the sun on our side of the Earth, and the moon is coming directly between us and the sun, which is uncommon because of the angles that we're at right now.
Right. So the way you want to think about it is that although, you know, we've got the moon going around the Earth every 27 or so days, it's not actually at the same angle as the orbit of the Earth around the sun. So it's only about twice a year that you'll get the two intersecting, that you will have an intersection of the orbit of the Earth and the orbit of the moon. And that's why – so we get some sort of eclipse twice a year, but not all of them will be total. There are some other issues that lead to us not getting a total eclipse. And then so about half of them are. And then you have to be on the right bit of the planet.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today we're talking with MU professor and director of astronomy, Angela Speck. Harvest Public Media reporter Chris Husted joined us in the studio.
And Chris, I know you have some questions that look more towards agriculture and science.
Right. I'm curious. So back here specifically in central Missouri, what kind of condition changes might we expect to see while we're watching this eclipse happen?
It takes about 3 hours total. And for the first hour, if you weren't paying attention, you wouldn't even know anything was going on. The sky doesn't change color. It's just normal. If you've got either a pinhole camera or the special eclipse shades, you can watch and you'll see, oh, part of the sun is missing. You know, it's kind of good that you can't see it without trying. You get to about an hour in or, you know, half an hour before you get to total eclipse. And you're still in partial phase, but now you've blocked out about 80% of the sun and the sky starts to change color. And you can kind of think of it as like, you know, on a stormy day when you go outside and you're aware that the sky looks weird. And you might not even be able to put your finger on it, but you know it looks weird. And you know there's going to be a thunderstorm. It's a bit like that. But now instead of being, you know, green, the sky is going to go slightly darker blue, kind of like the colors that you get right after sunset. Mm. So it's still blue. It's still quite light, but it's darker than usual. And at that point, we're going to start to see animals reacting because a lot of animals have, you know, twilight behaviors, especially birds. And it seems that, you know, there's lots of anecdotes about these things happening at different eclipses. And it seems to happen wherever in the world they are, if there are birds. And people say, oh, the birds go crazy. Actually, I think what we see is that, you know, after sunset on a normal day, birds do that swarming thing, right? And they make lots of noise. And then it gets dark and they all land and go to sleep. Well, during an eclipse, the birds all start swarming around, but we're not quite sure why they're doing it because the sun's still up, right? But from their point of view, the sky is the right color. But then it goes dark. And it doesn't go through, you know, when the sun sets, it might take an hour to actually get dark. We don't get past about the first half an hour in darkness, and then it goes to full moon dark, and it does it fast, like really fast. So the birds all just land and shut up. And so you have this contrast of they're making lots of noise and flying around in that, like, 20 minutes before darkness to it goes dark and now they're all quiet. And there'll be other animal behaviors too. But once it goes to full moon dark, you can see things that you wouldn't normally get to see during the day. You get to see stars. You get to see planets. We get to see the corona of the sun, which is this – it's actually the atmosphere of the sun. It's always there, but it's only about as bright as the full moon. And so with the sun out, even with a tiny bit of the sun showing, you just can't see it. And so there's lots of things to see in the sky. It also gets colder because we blocked out the sun with a big rock. Mm-hmm. And so it gets colder. And that change in temperature also generates wind. So the temperature drops, so the air pressure drops. But the air pressure outside of the shadow of the moon is not dropping, so you get air currents. And so there's a lot going on in the couple of minutes that you get in darkness.
Piggybacking on the animal behavior, is it a weather climate cue that we think animals take or plants might take because of the temperature and the nighttime showing up way more than earlier than they anticipated?
So one of the interesting things is, like I say, a lot of the data that we have is anecdotal. It's, you know, there's an eclipse somewhere on the planet every year and people tell stories about what they see. But it's never really been studied systematically. And so we have ideas about, is this an illumination thing? You know, the amount of light they're receiving goes down. Is that what it is? Is it a temperature effect? Is it, you know, what are the pieces? Is it all of that? And so actually, that's some of the science that's going to get done. And there's a lot of citizen science projects on this. But that's some of the science that we can do this time, because normally you get maybe a couple of minutes or 5 minutes in darkness, but you don't have it over land for a very long time in the same country. And now we have it over land for a long time. We can actually accumulate a lot more data.
What are some of those questions that scientists might be looking at during this window?
So, like I say, it's what is the, you know, if you have a plant that is mutated so that you don't expect it to be able to notice the light changes, you'll be able to see, okay, this one that's not mutated is now reacting to the change in light. This one isn't. If it's temperature, it's going to have a slightly different mutation, right? So there are things like that. And there are people in plant sciences who are looking at what plants can we look at that have fast responses that are that we think we know what's going on. And that's what we're going to do. And it's not just the plants. There's going to be people looking at bees and people looking at, you know, cows and things like that. I don't know how many people know this, but the university actually has some land up in Wyoming. And so I was up there in June, and the reservation that's close to that land is the Wind River Reservation. They have a bison herd. And so I think I've just about convinced them that they're going to have webcams on the bison herd to see what they do. Because, you know, we can watch cows in lots of countries, but bison, that'd be cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm just imagining like the animals in my life and how they react to winds and changes. And I imagine that it'll be dramatic. What are you as a astrophysicist most excited to look at?
Oh, all of it. I mean, you know, this is the thing, is that it's not just something that you see. You're going to feel that change in temperature. You're going to hear what the animals are doing. There's also, depending on how many people you have around you, there's a lot of gasping and cursing. Mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of, you know, imagine the first time you've ever seen the Grand Canyon. You've seen pictures of it, but it doesn't do it justice. And then you see it and you're like, now imagine that, but it has a volcano erupting in the middle and it's in space. And that's kind of how people react to this. And so you get all of these sounds to take in. And I want to take in all of it. I don't want to, you know, only see a bit of it. I want to see all of it. You know, you're going to have stars, you're going to have planets, you're going to have the corona, you're going to have, you know, twilight colors on the horizon. There's so much to take in. And actually the hard part is you only have 2.5 minutes to take it all in.
I was wondering, and I don't know if this is something you know a lot about, but I feel like it's such a – the stars always make people feel small, and they make us think about, you know, the universe beyond ourselves. And this is such an extreme event. It calls up, I think, a lot of deep feelings in people. Do you know much about how societies before ours related to the eclipse?
So there are lots and lots of old stories and myths, and a lot of them have a consistent story. Like if you look at folklore behind these things, a lot of the time it's an animal that is eating the sun. So with the Vikings, I think it's Fenrir the wolf that's basically then eating the sun instead of just chasing it. But with Native Americans, it depends on which nation or tribe. So for the Navajo, the older stories and some of the more traditional Navajo still won't watch it because it's taboo. Whereas the Cherokee, it's another, I think it's a frog that eats the sun. In China, it's a dragon because, you know, that's what happens in China. You know, so there's kind of consistent stories of, well, if we believe that, you know, it's a chariot that's being chased across there, then something has got to be stopping it and things like that. So, but yeah, there are lots and lots of stories about why this happens, which is kind of interesting because you have to have a long oral history because the time between having an eclipse in a given location is a long time.
Yeah, so somebody has to sort of be bouncing it up the generations. When would be the next time in North America that we could see a total eclipse?
So strangely, we haven't had one on mainland US since 79. Mm-hmm. The next one's in 2024.
Oh, wow.
And actually, it doesn't come over Columbia. But the southeast part of Missouri gets both. So where the two paths cross is actually close to Carbondale, Illinois. But it means places like St. Genevieve, Cape Girardeau, Perryville, that area of the state, they will get both. So, you know, once you've seen this one, you'll want to make sure you get to, you know, the eastern part of the state to see the next one.
Or if we don't do this one correctly, we have a chance in 9 years or 8 years.
Exactly.
We haven't wasted our one chance.
But except that one's in April, and so, you know, the weather prospects are not nearly as good.
Yes.
I have some questions about the moon and the impact with the moon. So is there anything dealing with gravity or tides that could be with this?
So one of the things we have to remember is that the moon is not doing anything extraordinary. It's just doing its orbit, and it just happens to be that that orbit takes in front of the sun. So it's not any stronger than any other new moon tide. So it's a spring tide. That's when the, you know, you have the combined effect of the sun and the moon because they're kind of in the same direction. there's a little bit of combining them because instead of being sort of in the same direction, they're now actually in the same direction. But really, the bigger issue is how close is the moon? And so when the moon is at its closest point to us, and a full moon or a new moon, that's the biggest tide. And it's the biggest difference between high tide and low tide. That's the effect it has. But yeah, eclipses don't really have an effect on tides.
I was reading about the stages as the moon moves in front of the sun, and I thought one of the coolest things was that you can actually sort of see some of the topography of the moon.
Oh yeah, no, it's really cool. So it's not exactly the topography, but yeah, it's I guess it is. So what you can think about is as the moon is moving into place and it's blocking out the sun, and you're going to need to have something that magnifies them to see this. You wouldn't see this naked eye. And then you need something with a filter because don't point binoculars at the sun.
Do not burn your eyes.
Good advice.
Exactly. But people think of the moon as this smooth orb, but it's not. It has mountains and valleys and craters. And so as it moves into place, you can make out those little lumps and bumps that are the mountains. We actually see that manifested in the last thing you see before totality, which is called the diamond ring. And the way you can think about it is that there's going to be one valley that's on the side of the moon that's, blocking it. It's moving into place. It hasn't quite blocked out the sun yet, but it's getting there. And there's one valley that'll be the last place that lets sunlight through. But because the sun is so bright, it's a million times brighter than the full moon. It means that even with a thousandth of it showing, it's still a thousand times brighter than the full moon. And so what that means is that last little valley, it looks like you've blocked everything out, but that last little valley is letting in so much light that it's still not safe to look at without protection, and it's really bright. And so what you get is you're starting to see the corona around the rest of the moon because you've blocked out the rest of the sun, but in that one spot, it's going to be so bright that it looks like a diamond. So we call it the diamond ring. And so ideally, that you see, and then the diamond sort of shrinks and dwindles as the moon moves into place. And then it's safe to take off your glasses. And then you have 2.5 minutes to take in everything. And then there'll be another diamond ring because there'll be another valley on the other side that is the first place that lets light through. And that's when you have to stop looking at it and put your glasses back on.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today we're talking with MU professor and director of astronomy, Angela Speck, about the upcoming total solar eclipse that we'll get an amazing view of from here in mid-Missouri.
And for anybody who's interested, NASA has tons of information about glasses, what kind of glasses, what you can look through, when you should not be looking directly.
So just to follow up on that a little, so there's actually a document that was put together by, I'm chairing a task force that is planning for the entire nation. And so we've been collaborating with NASA, but we're NSF funded. And one of the things that people don't realize is that NASA's mission is to do space-based work, right? They don't do ground-based work. Mm. They might do stuff in airplanes or in balloons. And for the eclipse, they are doing a great job and there's going to be all of this stuff around. But actually, NSF funds all ground-based astronomy. And so, or federally funded ground-based astronomy. And so it's actually a great collaboration between NSF being ground-based and NASA being space-based. And so we work together, and the task force I'm on is funded by NSF. And so we have this safety information that is endorsed not only by NASA and NSF, but also by the American Academy of Ophthalmologists, the American Academy of Optometrists, and other similar organizations, because we really want you to believe us. and so I just want to mention a website that NASA has got a great website, but they have some issues with what they're allowed to post because they're a government website. They are a federal website. They have a .gov address. The NSF website is hosted by the American Astronomical Society, which is a nonprofit, which has slightly different rules. Mm. So our website is able to post things that NASA cannot because we can post things about commercial sites. Mm. And that website is eclipse.aas.org. And it's exactly the same document as they have on the NASA site. But then there's also other things on there about how to take photographs. It's got resources for teachers and so on.
I had a quick follow-up. You mentioned some citizen science projects. I'm curious what some of those are that are going to be going on during this eclipse.
So there are several different projects going on. I'll start with the animal one, which is using an app that already exists called iNaturalist. And it's basically collecting data on what animals and plants are doing around you using an app. But that way we can collect data from thousands, millions of people all the way along the path. It's actually championed by the California Academy of Sciences, and it's called Life Responds. There are a couple that are about getting data on what the corona looks like, so the atmosphere of the sun for the whole of the path of the eclipse. One is called the Eclipse Mega Movie, and that's basically they want to collect as many images and movies as possible. If you have really great imaging, you know, you've got good cameras and things like that, they will send you instructions on how to do a really great job. But they'll take whatever they can get, and then they're going to put it all together into a huge movie of everything along the way. And basically, they just need to know your location. But that's the Eclipse Mega Movie. And that is partly sponsored by Google, and but is out of Berkeley, California. Then there's an Eclipse project that is a similar thing, but instead of just collecting lots and lots of data from different instruments, it's 68 identical telescopes and instruments to collect the data distributed all the way along the path. So I believe there are 5 or 6 locations in Missouri. And so, you know, you've got locations all the way along the path. And we are one of those locations. And different locations have chosen different ways to do this. I recruited through the high school, so we have one of my graduate students is taking the lead, and then we have high school students from Battle and Rockbridge high schools, and they'll be the ones actually doing the experiment. But different places along the path will do that. And basically that's taking 2 different color images of what the corona looks like, and that allows us to look at both temperature and composition and how it changes over the 94 minutes it takes the shadow to cross the continent.
Wow, cool.
There's a couple of others that are a little smaller. So there's one that Candy Galen is doing, which she's engaging with 5th graders. So she's a prof in biology, and she got funding from our NSF Eclipse Task Force that was to study bees. But it's also doing, you know, art meets science and working with kids and so. So that's part of it. There's another one that NASA put out a call for cross-disciplinary, so not looking just into space. And atmospheric science is doing that one. Now, some of it is just collecting data with their own instruments, but there will be, and I actually am behind schedule, I'm in charge of the citizen science piece. So if you're interested in learning how to do temperature measurements, I'm going to be recruiting people. I've kind of got a distribution of, so it's basically people that are on US 54 along the path, and then people that are on the center line of the path that goes from more or less Fulton-ish all the way out to Marshall. And so, but that's again one that, you know, we're going to have people collecting temperature data so that we can see how the temperature changes over the whole cross section of the path.
A lot of options for people to get involved.
Yes. That's exciting. And the data collection possibilities seem like, well, like you said before, they've just – it's never been greater.
Right. I mean, there are so many things we can do. There's some others like that are a little trickier to do from a citizen science point of view, but having that time. One of the things that people don't often realize about how we do astronomy is that – I don't know how many people realize now because of how cameras work, but normally if you want to take a picture of something faint, you have to look at it for longer, right? And so you just keep the camera pointed at it for longer and longer. That's a problem with electronics and things moving. And so when you're doing astronomy, you might take an image for, you know, a minute and then do it for another minute and then do it. You want 10 minutes, but if you do 10 minutes at once, that's not going to work. So you do it 10 times 1 minute and then you add them all together, okay? But what that means is that let's say you take an image of the sun in coastal Oregon, and then Salem, and then in Madras, and then in, you know, Boise is not in the path, Idaho Falls, and then in Jackson, and so on. Because the stars aren't going to move, you can justify them. You can line them up, align them to each other, and essentially get what is the equivalent of a 90-minute exposure time.
Wow. Smart.
And so, you know, and that means that you can test some ideas about general relativity that maybe, you know, general relativity was first tested during an eclipse in 1919, But there are still details that we can dig into with things like that.
And what is general relativity for the layperson?
Okay, so most people have heard of Albert Einstein, mm-hmm. and he is, you know, this is his big work. It's actually not what he got his Nobel Prize for, but this is the thing that he's most famous for. 1915, he publishes this idea. And basically what it does is it's about gravity, but it's about thinking about space in a different way. And so what he did was he replaced Isaac Newton as the way we think about how gravity works. Now, most of the time, you can go back to using what Newton said, and it works just fine. And that's what, if you learn gravity in school, that's what you'll learn. You'll learn about Newton. But in extreme situations, it's really important to follow what Einstein does, because Newton's work doesn't work anymore. It breaks down. Now, one of the implications of general relativity is that light will be affected by gravity. So we think of gravity as being you've got something that's massive and something else that's massive, and they pull on each other. And what he suggested was that actually the gravity is affecting the shape of space, and it means that light gets affected too. And so what happens is that stars will look like they're in the wrong position during an eclipse. So let me just kind of guide you through that. Normally, if you're looking at stars at night, the sun is on the other side of the planet. It's not between you and the stars. It's nowhere near, right? So you see them as in the positions that they're supposed to be. But now you're going to look at them during an eclipse, and the stars that are closest to the same direction as the sun, that starlight will get bent because the sun is massive, and it will pull that light towards it. And it basically acts like a lens. But it's kind of like if you look at a straw in a glass of water or look in a pool and the bottom looks closer to you, it's the same effect. The light gets bent, and so they appear in the wrong places. And although that was first done in 1919, not long after Einstein came up with it, there's details there. So we know that it's true. We know that light is distorted by gravity. But there are details at the level of, you know, well, how much is it? Is it really doing it exactly as we think it should? And that actually has implications for things like GPS, because we're talking about essentially what is the path of the light. And when you're talking about how GPS works, it's all about radio, which moves at the speed of light. But then if the distances aren't exactly what you think they are, it's going to put your position in the wrong place.
God, this just like blew my mind.
But, you know, that's one of the more tangible aspects of astronomy, is that it allows us to test some of these ideas that have practical applications.
Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And, of course, thank you to our guest, MU Professor Angela Speck, for joining us to talk about the August solar eclipse. Thanks also to my colleague, Harvest Public Media reporter Chris Husted. If you'd like to listen to this show again, visit us online at kbia.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we're at IntersectKBIA. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection, here on KBIA 91.3 FM.